Case number 20-1870, Marvin Gerber et al. Versus Henry Herskovitz et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Susselman, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mark Susselman, on behalf of the appellants Marvin Gerber and Dr. Miriam Brisk, I wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case involves the intersection between two fundamental rights protected by the First Amendment, the right of free speech and the right of the free exercise of religion. While the facts of the case involve Judaism and the right to worship in a synagogue, the implications of this case go beyond one religion and one house of worship. The decision in this case will have a profound effect on the contours of free speech in the context of members of every faith who want to worship in peace without being harassed, insulted, and denigrated by people who claim that their conduct is political speech expressed in a public forum and is inviolate and not subject to judicial equitable relief. And let me be clear, the plaintiffs in this case have never claimed that what they were seeking was to shut down the right of the protesters to express their anti-Semitic, anti-Israeli, and anti-Zionist propaganda everywhere in Ann Arbor. They have acknowledged in their briefs that the protesters do have a First Amendment right of free speech to express their views anywhere else they want, but not repeatedly in proximity to a Jewish house of worship, where plaintiffs maintain their entitled...
Mr. Susselman, there's one point in your brief where you seem to suggest or imply that the district judge is somehow racially biased because the judge failed to cite a case in the district court's opinion. And speaking only for myself, I think that sort of allegation of racial or ethnic bias against the district court for no good and sufficient reason sort of detracts from your credibility as an advocate. And I just wonder where you got the temerity to do that.
Well, Your Honor, the case in point was Well versus Rhodes. And we submit that it was in many respects, it was on point with the case on appeal. That is, the case
you're claiming that because the judge didn't cite a particular case in the judge's opinion, that the judge was motivated by bias for failing to cite a case, which is a pretty extreme position.
But Your Honor, it was a significant case because...
That doesn't matter. I mean, the judge may fail to cite a case for all kinds of reasons. But for you to claim that the judge is biased for that reason...
I didn't make that claim, Your Honor. Wait a minute.
We both can't talk at the same time.
Sorry, Your Honor.
I've just never seen anything like that from an attorney.
I just questioned why a case that was on point in all respects involving offensive speech in front of a home.
Mr. Susselman, I have a really quick suggestion. You're allowed to distinguish cases. You're allowed to do whatever you want to do, frankly, but you probably ought to apologize to the extent it looked like you were questioning the motives of the judge. I mean, if you want to make that the pivot point of your case, go for it. But you're going to meet a lot of resistance.
I apologize then. That was not my intention. I just thought it was a significant case that was not addressed. Sorry.
All right. Okay. You can proceed with your argument.
The plaintiffs are acknowledging the briefs.
Mr. Susselman, let me say what I think is your best argument and then try to see if it has all the components you need. Article 3 injury is, that's the key pivot point of the district court decision. And you have an injury in fact question. That's something the courts have been paying a lot of attention to. We have some case law that says emotional distress may count as an Article III injury. I mean, you know, Snyder versus Phelps is a pretty good example of a case where that seems to be the heart of the injury, emotional distress. That seems to be what you're suggesting. Correct. Here. So I'm saying that's all a good argument. My one question is whether you've pled enough facts in your complaint to satisfy, you know, you can't just put a label on it and just say emotional distress. Do you think you have enough facts here to have a plausible claim of emotional distress, a la Snyder versus Phelps? I realize they didn't get into the Article III point in that case, but I'm just, that seems to be a key question here, whether you've got enough in your complaint on that.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the two plaintiffs who are members of the congregation have seen these signs, which some of which are anti-Semitic. They've seen these signs every time they go to the house of worship to pray. The signs have been there every Saturday morning for over 17 years now. One of the plaintiffs is a Holocaust survivor and has been very distressed by seeing the signs. We attached affidavits by other members of the congregation and former members of the congregation who expressed how much emotional stress they experienced.
Remind me in those affidavits what they said in addition to the label of emotional distress. Like, did they describe a sleeplessness or things like that?
Well, one of them is described how she was accompanied by her children, and they had to change where they crossed the street in order to avoid seeing the signs or being approached by the protesters. They had to explain to their children that they should ignore the signs. One of their children attended the synagogue from the age of 3 to 11, and she submitted an affidavit explaining how upset she was, that she felt she was under attack as a Jew, that she only felt relief when they moved to another state, and she felt she could attend services without being harassed. Dr. Brisk expressed her concern as a Holocaust survivor, that she felt she was under attack.
All right, so let's say there's enough evidence to plausibly show emotional distress. The other way you could think about this is, you know, it has to be a legally plausible claim. And, you know, as you're aware, see Snyder versus Phelps, there's a lot of First Amendment protection in this area. You know, even for what looks like, you know, is nothing sacred. Think about Snyder versus Phelps protesting that funeral of a, you know, veteran. So what about the possibility that it's just such an uphill climb on the First Amendment that it's not, you don't have Article III standing, you know, see the Steel Co. case, because it's just not a remotely plausible First Amendment claim.
Well, let me address that, Your Honor. In Snyder versus Phelps, the Supreme Court held that their First Amendment rights, the father's First Amendment rights, and the other individuals attending the funeral were not violated because they were not a captive audience. They could not see the signs during the funeral. This is totally different, Your Honor. There are five factors that we submit to distinguish this case from all other cases that are cited by the appellees. That is, this is targeted picketing in a residential area. And Judge Sutton, you dissented in Dean versus Byerly on that very issue. This is targeted picketing in a residential area in spades, happening every Saturday morning for 17 years. They're also a captive audience, unlike the case of the Skokie case, where the Supreme Court held, well, if you don't go downtown, you wouldn't see the Nazis march. This is a case where the protesters deliberately go out of their way every Saturday morning to confront the congregants. So they're a captive audience. They can't avoid seeing the signs. It also involves children that were not involved in either the Skokie case or the Bible Believers case, for that matter. We distinguish the Bible Believers case because The ethnic festival, they were not a captive audience.
You know, the whole Barnett, you probably know the Gobitis Barnett saga during World War II and Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, most of the Jehovah's Witnesses, they proselytized. That was a key part of their faith. And they would classically proselytize on Sunday mornings in front of Catholic churches. From their perspective, that was where they were going to most effectively proselytize. There was no way for someone going to that Catholic church to avoid what they were saying, you know, coming out of the service. I know Barnett doesn't implicate that exact point, but that was the essence of what the Jehovah's Witnesses were doing. We wouldn't have a First Amendment without Jehovah's Witnesses cases. I mean, it's like half of the case law. So, you know, you can argue it's most distressing for the person that needs to go to services on Saturday, but the other side of it is the people that want to speak. That's the most effective time to speak from their perspective.
I'm out of time.
Well, you can answer if you can respond if you like. If you don't have a response, that's fine as well.
Well, I don't recall in the facts of the Jehovah's Witness case how many times they went to the church, but this is every Saturday morning for over 17 years. It also involves children who see the signs. It's also, I don't know if the church was in a residential area, but the synagogue is in a residential area, and this is targeted picketing, which in Dean versus Biley, Your Honor, you indicated even that one case of the law student picketing the house, I believe it was two times, that wasn't protected by the First Amendment because it violated a Michigan statute.
Okay, I think I've got your answer. Thank you.
Thank you. You're from opposing counsel, Mr. Shea.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Shea, on behalf of the protester defendants in this case. Just a quick aside, in your dissent, Judge Sutton, in Dean v. Byerly, it was not on the ground that you thought the judiciary could create an injunction for something like this. It's that you thought there was a statute that could be enforced, a la Frisbee. So it's a different, it was a different basis for your dissent. Let me jump into my argument, and I'll confess that I find the law of standing to be murky. It is not always easy to assess where its contours are. But I think at essence, to me at least, it means that a plaintiff's claim must be something that a court has authority to do something about. Justice Alito in Spokio v. Robbins explained that there are Article III constraints that the concept of standing go to directly. That in order for a court to have a case or controversy properly before it, there must be a claim that the court can do something about without intruding into Article I or Article II powers of the legislature, of the Congress, or of the executive branch.
I'm struggling with, I agree with your murkiness point, so you have me there, but emotional distress, it's pretty hard to imagine that Article III wipes out emotional distress claims. I can imagine some rules about making sure they're plausibly pled and a little bit of care there, but I have to say this case seems to satisfy it, whether it's the actual injury or the causation. It seems pretty, you know, that's quite plausible to me. So I guess I was a little afraid that what seemed to be happening was thinking about injury too much through the lens of whether it was a good First Amendment claim. And I'm pretty confident we're supposed to separate those things. I mean, unless the claim is just really wacky, see Steele Co., we're not supposed to think about Article III injury in terms of how strong the legal claim is. You may have, I think you do have a very strong legal argument under the First Amendment, but I think those are supposed to be separated. And it seems funny, I realize, to distinguish, well, this was 12b1, it should have been 12b6, but it's 12b1. And without jurisdiction, you know, you don't have jurisdiction. And we have to sort that out first.
Yeah, I understand you're concerned about the bootstrap problem. I get it. I think that's different. The fact that you can have a legitimate standing analysis that relies on similar jurisprudential concepts and similar First Amendment principles in both the standing analysis and the failure to state a claim analysis doesn't mean that it's a bootstrap. It simply means that the same concepts and principles can be applied to either. Judge Roberts chose to apply those concepts in the standing field rather than in the 12b6 field. She just found it unnecessary to reach the 12b6 arguments. She also found it unnecessary to reach other standing arguments such as redressability, which I think is in play here. And as our briefs explain.
Well, I don't understand redressability. I don't understand the redressability argument. It seems pretty easy to issue an injunction and that redresses the injury.
It has to be a constitutionally valid injunction.
No, you're back to blurring. Article 3 is redressability without regard to whether the claim satisfies 12b6 or, for that matter, summary judgment.
I get back to the standing means it's got to be a claim the judiciary can do something about. And if the law of First Amendment, as clear as it is here, says that peaceful protest speech in streets and sidewalks.
So Snyder versus Phelps should have been a 12b1 case.
That's a good question. I don't know the lower court treatment of Snyder v. Phelps. I don't know if standing is raised down there.
I don't think it is a good question. I really don't see a world in which Snyder versus Phelps should have been a 12b1 case. That's what I'm agreeing with.
But until Snyder came down, I'm not. Maybe you're right. But now that Snyder is down, doesn't it change the equation? Doesn't it change the calculus? Doesn't Snyder say firmly that?
No, you still have injury, in fact, causation, redressability. You just have a legally implausible claim, dismiss it on 12b6 grounds.
I believe that legal implausibility can be addressed on 12b1 grounds as well. Because, Judge Sutton, if you did not, if the court were to address the merits, perhaps wrongly, aren't you straying into the legislative realm, for instance? Isn't the lesson of Frisbee and Dean v. Byerly that a court cannot enjoin otherwise protected speech because that is something that only a legislature can do?
Just to be succinct on the standing issue, isn't the proposition that there's no legally protected interest not to be exposed to ideas with which you disagree? Isn't that the essence of your argument?
It is the essence of our argument, both underlying our standing defense and underlying our merits defense. I believe it can support both, Judge Clay. I recognize Judge Sutton's concern that it's a bootstrap, but I believe that the same principles independently can address both concepts, the threshold issue of standing and the merits defense that the First Amendment doesn't permit the government to regulate, or the courts, certainly without a statute even in place to consider, to regulate speech on public streets and sidewalks, regardless of how offensive. This is a, I believe that the fact that this is not a legally plausible claim makes it one that does not allege an injury that is properly cognizable by a court. And that, I think, that's where the rubber meets the road on standing. And the cases cited by the appellants, where certainly emotional distress in many, many contexts is sufficient to provide standing for a plaintiff's claims. We're not suggesting that Article 3 does not accommodate emotional impacts, emotional injury.
Can I ask you this question? Let's just say, in a, obviously this is a hypothetical, Snyder versus Phelps comes out the other way. Okay, no First Amendment protection. Would you say the allegations of the parents about emotional distress would have sufficed to clear Article III?
Would a claim
of emotional distress about this kind of protest at your child's funeral suffice for Article III injury and causation? In a world in which the law in Snyder versus Phelps comes out the other way. And I would say that has to be yes.
I think it would have to be yes because the law came out the other way.
I'm saying this is real emotional distress. Who would possibly question a parent's emotional distress about a protest at their son's funeral of that sort?
And I am not questioning the sincerity of Mr. Susselman's client's claims of emotional distress in this context.
In that sense, they are like the parents in Snyder versus Phelps, is what I'm analogizing.
Yes, except that Snyder... I'm sorry, Judge, I interrupted you.
Well, I'm just trying to liberate you from the meaning of the First Amendment, because I think Article III is separated from the meaning of the First Amendment.
I agree, except insofar as where the meaning of the First Amendment is so clear that it takes away emotional injury as a plausible, cognizable injury for standing purposes. I believe you can get there that way, and I believe Judge Roberts did. And I don't believe that injunctive relief is constitutional, which in this context, which is a redressability reason, absence of redressability reason for why her ruling on standing was appropriate. And I just went to zeros. Unless there's another question, I appreciate the exchange. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from your co-counsel, Mr. Wilhelm.
Tim Wilhelm on behalf of the City of Ann Arbor defendants. The lower court's dismissal of plaintiff's claims for lack of standing should be affirmed for two reasons. First, plaintiff's claims seek to improperly turn the First Amendment on its head and use it in a way that it was never intended. And the implications of what plaintiffs are asking for, which are clearly contrary to the First Amendment, reveal the legal deficiencies of their claims. And second, plaintiffs fail to satisfy any of the three elements of Article III standing. As to the first reason, the First Amendment was not designed to be used, as in this case, as a sword to stifle other speakers' lawful speech on matters of public concern, which the listener finds to be offensive, insulting, or even harmful. Plaintiffs are improperly asking for a heckler's veto.
Mr. Wilhelm, let's say hypothetically, I'll put it in my own terms. Let's say hypothetically, I'm disinclined to agree with the district court judge on standing, but think the 12B6 argument has a lot to it. What should I do? Should I say, well, this was a no jurisdiction decision, we should send it back and let the district court judge realize she has jurisdiction and now deal with 12B6 or if need be summary judgment? Or should we be taking this on ourselves even though there is no 12B6 ruling?
I think the point that the court is trying to get at is the First Amendment case law, when evaluating the injury in fact component, requires that it be a concrete injury, which in part looks at Congress action and whether traditionally the law has viewed this type of claim as providing a basis for to proceed and have standing. In this particular case, the lower court looked at the case law regarding the First Amendment, and this is where there seems to be confusion between the merits of the First Amendment claim and the concreteness of the injury for standing purposes under Article III. The court ruled that was a negative, that First Amendment case law does not recognize listeners' subjective reactions to lawful protected First Amendment speech as actionable. Specifically, this means that subjective, intangible, emotional injuries, such as those alleged here, are not a sufficiently concrete injury for Article III standing purposes. Listeners do not get to silence speakers they find offensive. Rather, as First Amendment law explains, the marketplace of ideas calls for more speech, not censorship. From there, the lower court found that the claims of emotional distress were a subjective chill. And in connection with that, it made clear there was no interference with the plaintiff's religious exercise. They were not blocked from accessing the property or entering the synagogue, and there was no interference with the services once they were inside. Based on its analysis, the lower court properly found that plaintiffs lacked a sufficiently concrete injury to establish Article III standing consistent with that traditional First Amendment existing case law.
Mr. Wilhelm, you're representing the city, right?
Correct.
I sort of assumed that you were taking separate time to address the claims against the city, but apparently you're not. So I have just a sort of a simplistic fundamental question. The lawyer for the plaintiffs in this case called the city and talked to the city attorney, right?
Yes.
Can't hear you.
Yes.
So the claim seems to be that the city then said he couldn't talk to anybody else at the city. I'm just sort of back on the common point that once a party is represented, a lawyer can't talk to anybody else involved with that party. But nobody, you don't seem to have pled that. Does that not apply here for some reason, either factually or legally?
I think it's applicable, but I think in the context of the interference with the right to grieve your government, I believe that the case that claim falls apart. That right does not provide the plaintiffs with or its counsel with a free access to all information, whether through the attorney or through the city staff.
I think you're missing the point. If you sue a company and the company is represented, you can't then just keep calling other employees at the company and say, "Well, I'm trying to obtain additional information." You got to get it through the lawyer. So why doesn't that apply here? Does the First Amendment change that analysis here?
I don't think so. I think that point does apply, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very
much.
All
right. Is there any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Judge McKeague, I just want to point out that there was no lawsuit filed when I contacted the employee in question. I was just seeking to obtain factual information about the ordinance. And I was not asking for a legal opinion from the employee. And that employee was then directed not to speak to me again. So I don't believe I was violating any ethical prohibition in my contacting him. There was no lawsuit filed. Therefore, the city attorney, the employee was not being represented by the city attorney with respect to the questions I was asking. I'd like to address the question about the application of an injunction. In the case of Madsen, the Supreme Court held that the application of an injunction in order to protect the constitutional right is appropriate. And is content neutral because an injunction can be specifically tailored to the facts in the case.
Mr. Sesselman, I'm with you on that point. Let's say hypothetically you're right about the district court that she shouldn't have dismissed it on 12B1 grounds for Article III case or controversy for standing reasons. What should our next move be? Should we, if we do what you say is right, should we remand to the district court in order to do 12B6 or possibly summary judgment, or should we take on the First Amendment argument merits ourselves?
Based on precedents of the Sixth Circuit, I would say that no, the court should remand it because the court has held that where there are factual issues still in dispute. And there are factual issues still in dispute. For example, whether there was a conspiracy, whether
If you think there are factual issues still in dispute, it's possible that you would like us to say that, right? We could issue a ruling that is in your favor on 12b6 grounds, saying this needs more discovery. Now,
yes, Your Honor.
I don't want to mislead you. We could also say the opposite, that there's a very strong First Amendment right here, and you could lose on 12b6 grounds. So with the veil of ignorance, which do you prefer?
That you remand for further development of the factual issues, which still remain. They were not addressed, they're not in the record. And there are factual issues that have to be sorted out. And
just for my own edification, what are the factual issues that are germane to the issues that you've pled and that the district court has ruled upon?
Well, whether the members of the congregation or the appellants do in fact constitute a captive audience is a factual issue. The effect on children, none of the cases that have been cited by the appellees involve children. The Bible Believers case didn't involve children. The Skokie case didn't involve children. So that's also a significant factor that has to be taken.
Well, when you're in a public venue, usually or frequently with lots of people, children are there, and at the Arab festival the Bible Believers, where the demonstrations were taking place, there were children all over the place.
So this is where I believe the application of 42 U.S. Code 1981 and 1982 come into play. And those statutes make clear, even as to private citizens who target people based on their race or ethnicity, that conduct, even First Amendment conduct, is not protected, I would submit. And I would also point out, by the way, a case that has not gotten much play in this appeal is the Beauharnais versus Illinois case, Your Honors, which has never been overturned, in which the Supreme Court held that a Illinois statute that criminalized malicious libel did not violate the First Amendment. And I submit, if that's the case, and I know that the relevance of that case is challenged by some, but it was cited by Justice Scalia in the RIV versus St. Paul case as still being good law. And if you can criminalize such conduct, I submit, Your Honors, you definitely can have an injunction that places reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on their free speech, which we're not challenging they have.
Counsel, it sounds like the issues you are proposing for discovery, the effect on members of the congregation and children and things like that, pertain to the issue of emotional distress. And here you've got people demonstrating on public property, not interfering with ingress or egress or anything else. And it sounds as though you still think that even for First Amendment purposes, that the case hinges on emotional distress. Is that right?
Certainly emotional distress is a large part of it, Your Honor, but it also is their right. So they have a First Amendment right of freedom of religion. And in Madison, private citizens who were protesting in proximity to an abortion clinic, the court held that the rights of the people, of the women going to the abortion clinic under the 4th and 14th Amendments was entitled to protection, even though it was being infringed on not by the state, but by private citizens.
Well, you can't find an abortion case where for First Amendment purposes, protesters were told that they couldn't protest in the vicinity of the abortion clinic such that the women could not see them. Those cases turn on disruption and preventing ingress and egress to the clinic, but I don't know of any abortion case where an injunction removed them from the vision or eyesight of people going in and out of the clinic and where there were any grounds on First Amendment grounds, an argument that you couldn't have people protesting in the vicinity of an abortion clinic would border on the frivolous for First Amendment purposes.
Well, you know, I would cite in response the case of Burson versus Freeman, in which a statute was sustained which prohibited citizens from approaching people who were approaching a place to vote. And the court held that their right to vote would be infringed not by the protesters or
Well, what does that have to do with this case? Because the facts don't suggest that the protesters were approaching or coming up to your clients. And that's not in the factual, the facts of this case.
Well, I believe the case of Burson versus Freeman pointed out that you didn't have to violate the right to vote by going into the voting venue and destroying the ballots. It was enough that individuals would approach or be present where the people were entering the voting place. And the court held that the right to vote was a substantial right that the statute prohibiting them from being in the vicinity of the voting, the defendants of being in the vicinity of the voting place could be protected by statute. And if that's the case, again, I would point out injunctions are content neutral. They held that in Madsen, and this court held that as well in Vitanel versus City of Upper Arlington, where the court held that an injunction is appropriate and is content neutral.
Mr. Sesselman, the another thing I'm curious about is how these abortion cases and right to vote cases really are applicable here, because it seems to me, in a more macro sense, those are cases where you're trying to influence somebody what they do when they go in the ballot, when they go in the voting booth, who they vote for, or you're trying to convince a woman not to go ahead and go in and get an abortion. Here, when we see what happened and the context, and we read the signs, it doesn't appear as if this protest was really directed at the individual members of this congregation at all. It wasn't. I don't see any indication that any of the protesters were trying to stop them or convince them, don't go to the synagogue, don't be a Jew, don't support Israel. The protesters happen to be using the fact that there was a synagogue there and that there were going to be people around to attract attention to their cause, as opposed to trying to motivate the individual actions of the congregants. And I'm interested, one, if you think that's a proper observation, and two, what effect, if anything, does that have on First Amendment jurisprudence?
Well, it is obviously a proper observation, but the protests did have effects on Mr. Gerber. He stopped attending that synagogue and started going to a different synagogue in order not to see the signs. Now, arguably, that was one of the motives and one of the objectives of the protest, is not just to express their views regarding Israel, but to deter people perhaps from going to the synagogue, which it did. And also to deter other people from wanting to join the synagogue. Why would you want to go join a house of worship where you have to face protesters every Sabbath morning? So I would submit it did have an effect in actuality, which is another factual issue regarding why it should be remanded to the district court.
I think we have your argument at hand.
Thank you.
And thank you for those arguments. I think we can conclude the arguments on this case, and the case is submitted for the court's consideration.